I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. The author of Gentlemen, Scientists, and Revolutionaries, The Founding Fathers in the Age of Enlightenment, Tom Shackman, is our guest this hour. He writes not only Ben Franklin, but Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and others tinkered, farmed using what they believed to be scientific and experimental principles, employed scientific analogies in their writing, couched their political ideas in scientific terms, fell in love with technologies, considered the U.S. as a grand experiment in independent democratic governance. Tom has written or co-authored more than 30 books. This is his first foray into revolutionary times. He has taught at NYU, lectured at Harvard, Stanford, Georgia Tech, the Library of Congress. He has been awarded the American Institute of Physics Science Writing Prize for his two-hour documentary. He's done a lot of documentaries as well, Absolute Zero and the Conquest of Cold. He's currently a consultant to the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation's Science and Technology Initiatives, and he does many more things as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I find we're going to talk about all of these founding fathers and what part of the natural universe excited them and what they did in those areas and whether or not it was a part of their religious beliefs or if it ran counter to their religious beliefs or if we even thought of everything in terms of if there was a divide between science and religion back in those times. So it should be a really interesting hour, and you are welcome to join us whenever you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for being with us.
Delighted to be here, Kathleen.
We're going to have a good time. Well, let's start with George Washington, because now that I know about your book and you're writing about him, I'll never think of him the same, because you write about during the Revolutionary War and against the wishes of the Continental Congress, he ordered doctors to use this still experimental vaccination technique to prevent his troops from being decimated by smallpox, which indeed may have saved the country, right?
It really did. The first task of a guerrilla warfare expert like Washington, although he didn't like to be referred to that way, is to preserve your army so that you can eventually win. When smallpox is taking 15% to 20% of your troops per year, you've got to do something about that first before you can do anything else. More troops were dying of smallpox during the first year of the Revolutionary War than were being killed on the battlefield.
And why was it against the wishes of the Continental Congress? What did they say about the vaccine?
Well, it was sort of experimental. We didn't really know much about proof in medicine at that time. And although the vaccine had been in use for about 50 years, it was still considered somewhat experimental. And there were physicians who believed that the inoculation procedure actually spread the disease rather than tried to prevent it. And that really had to do with how long you kept people in isolation. We're hearing about this just today with Nancy Schneiderman from NBC,
yes,
who didn't obey the rules on staying out of circulation long enough and may be considered contagious for Ebola.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a period during which somebody who was inoculated for smallpox had to stay out of sight and certainly out of contact with the rest of the world, until the disease had sort of run its course and that person had acquired immunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the problem. Also, they didn't want a lot of these officers in the Army out of commission for a couple of weeks because you might invite a British sally against them. So there were both political and physiological reasons for being against this vaccine. And various legislatures in the colonies, as well as the all colonial legislature, had sort of passed edicts saying, please don't do this. And if you're in the Army and you do this, we'll kick you out.
Hmm. And you also weave in the stories of others of the founding fathers who had the vaccine. We're pretty familiar with John Adams and with Abigail as well, who had, she was inoculated and her children, and others of the founding fathers did the same, right?
They did. But, for example, Martha Washington had not been inoculated at the beginning of the war, and that was the reason that Washington didn't want to let her come with him into Boston after the town was liberated. Then she was inoculated in Philadelphia after that.
Mm-hmm. George Washington, we'll move to others in a moment, so advanced, you write, that he was considered America's most scientific farmer. I think we think of him as...
Isn't that interesting?
Yes.
I mean, most of us don't know any of these things about Washington.
No.
About his medical things or the farming. And after the war, when he returned to Mount Vernon, he determined to be the best farmer he could. And he was going to take stuff from the bottom of the Potomac River and put it on his field like manure. He thought that was the first step in the transformation into gold.
Hmm.
And when he said this in a letter to a man named Arthur Young, who was the reigning agrarian expert in Great Britain, Young was absolutely charmed by it. You know, he was a Brit through to the core, and he didn't like Washington because Washington had just beaten their pants off. But he had to admit that this was a genius type of farmer in the making. So he set out to help Washington in every way he can. And Washington experimented on his own and consulted with Young by mail and developed into what Young then called the most scientific farmer in America.
Hmm. Tell me about, you spend some time in the book talking about the educational tract for each of the founding fathers. In many ways, it would have been unusual for them to have received any kind of scientific instruction. Many of them were schooled with a belief in classical education, right?
Well, that's not really so. Both Jefferson and Adams had very fine scientific education. Jefferson more so than Adams. Adams is about 5 years older. And his favorite course at Harvard, he later wrote, was the one that he took in science, which was by one of the foremost astronomers of the day named John Winthrop.
Mm-hmm.
And Jefferson fell under the influence of a man at William & Mary named William Small, who was really quite an interesting figure in his own right, who was a thoroughgoing scientist and very influential in many circles. And so they both received somewhat of a scientific education. Madison, who was at Princeton at that time, which was a little bit later, they didn't believe yet in science. That was coming just about a year after Madison graduated. And George Washington, of course, was a surveyor, even though he had finished his formal schooling at age 11 when his father died. He became a surveyor, which relies heavily on mathematics and a little bit on physics as well.
And when you say they didn't believe in science, what did they believe in its place then?
They believed in the logic of science, in the idea that something could be shown to happen organically in science, that it was possible to prove things, and that if you couldn't prove it, it probably was wrong. So this is what I call a scientific attitude towards life, as opposed to a very strict religious attitude where people believe something because they have faith in something or another.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to say, and it's really important for us to understand, that for the founding fathers, their religion and their science were not incompatible. The idea that science was different than religion really didn't come about 50 years after their deaths, somewhere in the 1830s and 1840s, when science and religion sort of began to really split, primarily because of the ideas of Darwin and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the 18th century, this was not so. The founding fathers were all pretty much deists. They had a strong belief in God, each one of them individually. What they didn't believe in quite so much were the established churches. And within their religion, within their understanding, their belief system, there was plenty of room for science. They didn't see anything wrong with believing both in God and in the facts of science.
And yet you describe, up until around 1750, and tell me why it changed in 1750, the vast majority of Europeans and American colonists knew little about Newton, Harvey, Boyle. They still held a biblically-based view of the natural world, one almost completely independent of science.
That's true for the great masses of people who were not college-educated, who didn't read a lot, and so on. But certainly after that, and partly as a result of people like Franklin who had access to newspapers, and who was by then closing in on being a world figure. Science began to come into the daily lives of people in newspapers and even in sermons. They would be debating what were the real causes of thunder and lightning and earthquakes. You know, was it God expressing his vengeance? Or was there another explanation? Was there a logical explanation that didn't necessarily invoke the divine? And that's what seemed to happen. So there was a generation that grew up in the 1750s and 60s and 70s that was beginning to believe in the efficacy of science and what science could teach people about the world and how it worked. And the logic of science, why things worked, and that you needed to prove something to someone in order to make them understand it and believe it. Mm. And this sort of consciousness grew throughout that period, the immediate pre-revolutionary period, so that by the time that the constitutional conventions were called, the Continental Conventions in 1774 and 75, people were believers in science, enough so, certainly among the delegates, that there was a sort of a general understanding of what science was, what it could do, and that it was certainly not wrong to believe in it, and that it had nothing to do with one's religious beliefs.
Mm. When we think of those founders, the one who really stands out in most of our modern minds is Benjamin Franklin. And you talk about his route to scientific thinking differing markedly from some of the other founding fathers. He was born earlier. How was it different, his route to scientific thinking?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that Franklin was born in 1705, so he's a grandfather when all these other guys are just entering fatherhood. Mm-hmm. At the time of around the Revolutionary War. Franklin grew up, left school at a certain age, became a printer's apprentice to his brother during the time of a smallpox epidemic in Boston in 1721, in which the brother founded a newspaper that was really all about smallpox and vaccination and so on. So he had an education in that quite early. And then in Philadelphia, he became under the influence of two men whose influence he solicited, who were both scientists, very good scientists in their very differing ways. And when he became wealthy, he sort of decided that he really would like to go a step further and devote himself to science, because that's what gentlemen did. And he also thought that it was a very good route to fame. And he was right. So he looked around for years to try and find the right science that he could do. Some of these sciences were a little bit closed to him because he didn't speak Latin and he didn't speak mathematics. He wasn't very good in math, he thought. He'd flunked it a couple of times, and he didn't speak Latin. So how was he ever going to read Newton, which was in Latin?
Right.
And so until someone smart said to him, you don't have to know Latin in order to understand what the basics of Newtonian physics are. And that gave him a sort of courage. And then there was a new field that was opening up called electricity. Nobody knew very much about it. And he was able to get in and do some very critical experiment and make a tremendous name for himself. He obtained what was then the equivalent of the Nobel Prize, which was the Copley Award of the Royal Society. This was the top science prize in the world at that time. And he became, because of that, the most famous American. So his attitude on science and what science was and what science did was that of a real practitioner. The other fellows, Adams and Jefferson especially, were appreciators of science and dabblers a little bit here and there in theories and in trying small experiments. But the real scientist among them was Franklin.
Hmm. And tell us about his religious views. They're rather interesting. You write about his father not wanting to waste money sending him to Harvard because it was an institution known for producing ministers, and Ben really didn't want to be a minister.
Well, Harvard was essentially a school for producing ministers at that time, just as Yale was. And it became pretty obvious to Franklin's father that Franklin, in his early teens, was not going to become a minister, that he didn't really like it. He wasn't in tune with the established church. And so it might not be a good idea, and it would certainly might be a waste of money to send him to Harvard. Interestingly, John Adams and his father had somewhat of the same argument 40 years later, in which Adams said, well, I really don't want to become a minister, but I'll go to Harvard because that's where a good education is. But, Dad, I want you to understand that I'm really not going down that path, even though you would like me to.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting the importance of certain professors in piquing all of their interest. You said earlier you talked about John Adams' science professor, John Winthrop. It seems as though many of them had some of them were from the Scottish Enlightenment, which I didn't know much about, and they really helped form these founding fathers' futures in some way and their profound interest in science.
Yes, it really did. The Scottish Enlightenment was very important, whereas Winthrop was by that point a third or fourth generation American. William Small came right out of who was the Jefferson's professor, came right out of the Scottish Enlightenment. And it's interesting to me that when Franklin was over in Edinburgh, he was the most comfortable and the happiest that he ever was in his life.
Really?
In the company of the Scottish philosophers and economists and scientists. He felt accepted by them. He felt that he was able to discuss his ideas and discuss their ideas. He was really happy in that thing. He sort of regretted that he had to return to London to do his duties as an agent for the Pennsylvania colony. But he escaped to Scotland when he could, and he certainly welcomed all of them, to Hume and so on, when they came through London.
Yeah, and they still have a lot of ideas in Scotland, don't they?
Yes.
Yeah. We'll welcome phone calls for our guest. We're talking with the author of Gentlemen Scientists and Revolutionaries, The Founding Fathers in the Age of Enlightenment. Tom Shachman is our guest. Tom has written a number of documentaries that have been seen on major broadcast outlets. He has written for the New York Times, Smithsonian, Huffington Post, History News Network, Foreign Policy. And this is his first, as he describes it, foray into the revolutionary era. And it looks at our founding fathers and traces their interest in science and looks at this whole, because we tend to think of them as being not being deists, looking at their view of religion and their view of science, but that there was no dividing line between that in their times. It's really fascinating. I mean, who would have thought? I mean, think about this. This is the thought for the day, that if it hadn't not been for George Washington getting his troops vaccinated against smallpox, we might not be here today, right? Because smallpox would have really run rampant. Well, here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter at @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, the author of Gentlemen Scientists and Revolutionaries, The Founding Fathers in the Age of Enlightenment, Tom Shachman is our guest this hour. And let's go to some phone calls. Chuck is calling in from Crivets first. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
Hi.
Just one thing I was remembering. The British were worried at one time that Franklin was going to make this giant reflective mirror pointed at their ships and incinerate them when the war was on. And I thought how fascinating how, you know, scientific progress also was something of a concern when it came to military technologies. What does Tom have to say about that?
Well, there were a number of wonderful and some harebrained ideas during the war. For example, Tom Paine decided that he would have a bow and arrow, except the arrow would be steel and it would have fire on the end. And he and the leading astronomer of the country, named David Rittenhouse, worked very hard on making these bows. The problem was you couldn't get something strong enough that would go far enough so it would be able to burn a boat in the harbor.
Hmm.
There was also something called the Bushnell Turtle, which was a one-man submarine that was supposed to go and attach bombs underneath ships. And that almost worked, and it could have worked very well, but The Continental Congress sort of didn't know how to support it. Then there were people, Franklin also went up and told Washington about a friend of his who had an idea of setting sort of burning bushes, bushes burning and rolling them down hills at the enemy, sort of the way that Mel Gibson did it in his picture about Scottish independence. So there were a lot of these ideas. Unfortunately, none of them were very good. What were good ideas, good technical ideas, by and large came from engineers trained in France who came over to help the United States. They were almost equally as important as Lafayette in the way we conducted our war.
Well, that was a great question that led to a whole lot of information, Chuck.
Well, I'm glad to hear some, you know, some interesting ideas. I didn't know all those things.
Right.
What did the engineers from France do? What were their improvements?
Well, for example, if you look into the Battle of Saratoga, for example, there's very important work done there. I don't want to go into all the details. You can read them in my book, but they were able to work things out so that the army was not obliterated at Saratoga. There was much of importance that went on during the Battle for Yorktown and the sieges that were leading up to it, as well as other things and fortifications at West Point and evaluations by these engineers of what was going on in many places. I like particularly one that happened at Valley Forge, where there was a question as to whether you should go out of Valley Forge and try to attack the British in Philadelphia or just let it go, and what would be best. And Washington had a lot of people being very gung-ho about what they ought to do. You know, to get out there and show them our medal and all of this. But the French engineer who was there said, no, 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 this is a very poor idea, and I'll show you why technically, because the engineers were also in charge of planning of that kind of thing. And it was his notions that finally convinced Washington that the best thing to do was hunker down and that the British would very soon leave Philadelphia in the spring of 1778, and that's what happened.
Fascinating.
So there was lots of stuff that went on that was decided essentially on a scientific basis, where decisions were influenced by logic and by the understanding made by people with technical and scientific expertise.
Yeah. Thank you, Chuck, very much for your interesting call. Tom Paine, you mentioned him a little bit earlier. We think of him as giving us the words for the revolution and the reasoning and the motivation for it. And you write about his relentless scientific popularization. What did he do? What did he write about?
Well, we've sort of forgotten that before Tom Paine wrote Common Sense, he was an editor in Philadelphia, and the magazine that he was working on, which had just come out, had sort of two prongs. One was to furthering the rebellion coming on in 1774, 75, 76, and the other was popularizing a lot of the science that was going on. So he was on these two tracks sort of at once. And then during the war, he was functioning more as a public relations man than as anything else, but his fertile mind was always coming up with things. I told you about the bow and arrow thing. Then he also tried to invent what he called a smokeless candle. And he and Rittenhouse, who was the astronomer, were also experimenting to find out whether explosives worked undersea, you know, without air to ignite them. So he was involved in that. And then after the war, he came up with a plan for the largest steel suspension bridge to date. Never been done before. And he and Jefferson corresponded about this for a while. And some of the correspondence is actually a little humorous when they're deciding which bolt goes where and what the circumference of this and that is. And he was never able to get the bridge built in the United States or even in France, even with Jefferson's help. And so finally he went back to England, and the bridge was erected in the north of England and stood there for about 100 years.
Oh, my. Oh, I never knew that. Let's go to Lori in Hales Corners next. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I had heard that Thomas Jefferson had sort of cut and pasted the Bible and had his own version of the parts of it that he believed in and accepted. And I was curious what caused him to do that, if it maybe was an Enlightenment influence or something, and then how that in turn influenced some of his decision-making and his philosophy of life, let's say.
Okay, let's start with what's called the Jefferson Bible, which, by the way, was distributed to members of Congress throughout the next 150 years. Only recently did they stop distributing that to incoming members of Congress. What Jefferson did was he decided that because of what his religious beliefs were, which was, in short order, that he believed in God, but he wasn't so sure about the church. And he wasn't so sure about the divinity of Jesus. So what he did was he cut and pasted so that there would be a version of the Bible that had to do with the morality and the teachings, and that did not have to do with whether or not Jesus was divine or any miracles or anything else. And in a sense, it was a cut-down moral version of the Bible. And he did this actually in answer to a request by a friend of his named Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was a fervent believer, by the way, and who was always after Jefferson to come back to the church. Mm-hmm. And he was challenged by Rush to say, could you please once and for all put down what your beliefs really are, because you've managed to avoid saying so for quite a while. And this was one of his responses to that.
Hmm, fascinating. And when you look at his monument, I have sworn upon the altar of God, eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. What's he addressing?
Well, he's actually addressing Rush. It comes to a quotation from a letter that he wrote to Rush, an answer about what is your religion, what is your spirituality. And when he's talking about tyranny there, Jefferson is really referring to the tyranny of established churches trying to tell people what to believe and in what manner to believe. His own belief was that, as we might put it now, that people had personal relationships to God or could, and that it was their business and not the business of anybody, of any intermediary whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And let's spend a little more time on Thomas Jefferson, president of the leading scientific organization, the American Philosophical Society. What was that, Tom?
Well, the APS, the American Philosophical Society, which, by the way, is still going strong, was founded by Benjamin Franklin with John Bartram in 1743. Then they couldn't get enough people involved, so it lay dormant for a while, and then was resuscitated when some challengers came on around in the 1760s. And since that time, it's been one of the leading scientific organizations in the country. And for many years, in the early part of our history, it was the scientific organization. And Rittenhouse, who was a close friend of Jefferson's, had succeeded Benjamin Franklin, who was the first president, upon Franklin's death. And when Rittenhouse died at a relatively young age, Jefferson was asked to become the president of the organization. And he was at that point about to become vice president of the United States and had not yet become. So he was president of the American Philosophical Society before he was vice president of the U.S.
Mm. And then you remind us that he had to get the Lewis and Clark expedition ready, so he brought together anatomy, botany, anthropology experts to tutor Lewis, right?
Yes. Meriwether Lewis was Jefferson's personal secretary, and there had actually been an earlier expedition in 1797 and Lewis had wanted to be in charge of that, but he was too young at that time, and the expedition didn't quite pan out, which is actually a wonderful story in itself. But when it came time to have what we now know as the Lewis and Clark expedition, Jefferson sent Lewis to Philadelphia, to the American Philosophical Society and its circle, and had their expert teach him various things about the major sciences that he would have to know if he was going on a collecting expedition, which is essentially what the Lewis and Clark expedition was. It certainly was going to explore, but they were also going to collect. And by the way, one of the things that they carried with them were small smallpox inoculation kits give to the Native Americans and to teach them how to do it so that that scourge would no longer decimate the Native populations as well as it has in the past.
That's fascinating. We're talking this hour with the author of Gentlemen, Scientists, and Revolutionaries, The Founding Fathers in an Age of Enlightenment. Tom Shackman is our guest. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Pepin? Is it? Or Pepin in Milwaukee. Hi, Pepin.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I just had a comment. It struck me for a very long time now that the underlying structure of our democracy seems to very much mirror the scientific method on multiple different layers. And I'm wondering if the Founding Fathers were actually aware of the scientific method or that was just kind of something in the mix at the time.
I think they were quite aware of it, although perhaps not under that title. I think they understood what it meant to do science in the sense of posing a question, investigating it, trying to figure out what went on, and then eventually drawing results and laws from that. If you look at the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson's preamble to it especially is set up like a scientific paper. You know, we're going to prove to all of your peers out there, we have to give you our reasons for doing things. And then here's our list of things that have gone wrong, and this is how they've gone wrong, and so on and so forth. And then we come to the ergo, the conclusion, therefore we have to break away. So the structure of that document alone is scientific in its import. Not legal, and it's not religious. It's much more scientific than it is legal or religious. It may have some overtones of those, but the basic underlying structure is fairly scientific.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder how many of them did. You start the book with members of young Ben Franklin's Leather Apron Club, where they're getting together people with no college education, and they ask each other, do you love truth for truth's sake, and will you endeavor impartially to find it and freely communicate it to others? I love that. We should start our talk shows that way to everybody who calls in, too.
That's a pretty good motto, isn't it?
It really is, yeah. I mean, were these kinds of clubs something? Tell me more about Ben's Club, and was that kind of pursuit of the truth something that was right in everybody else's minds, the Founding Fathers?
Well, I don't know whether it was, but specifically, it's certainly well-worded there. And when a sort of next-generation club of that sort came up in Philadelphia, they adopted the very same methods and even the words of that sort of pledge.
Huh.
But basically, you have to remember that Franklin's group that he started gathering in the 1720s and 1730s in Philadelphia were people who didn't get to go to college. They were artisans. They were entrepreneurs. There were similar clubs in colleges. There were certainly one associated in Harvard with a number of people that we can track, and there were others in other clubs. Jefferson's group down at William and Mary basically consisted of people who were comfortable in science. This included the reigning governor of Virginia at that time, who was actually the lieutenant governor, Farquhar, as well as Mr. Small and Jefferson, and George Wythe, who was a lawyer, but who also had some scientific background and training. And there were smaller clubs in Baltimore and other large cities. There was one in New York as well. These were people who met to discuss things.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't necessarily going to do experiments. They sometimes discussed questions that were sort of in the nature of experimental, like are having public bathhouses good for the sanitation of the city or bad for it?
Hmm.
Well, it's sort of a scientific question, but it's something that's really up for debate.
Yeah, so how did they answer that?
Well, the question is, you know, what's good for the people and what's not good for the people. Now, some of this is supposition, but you could also bring facts to bear. And that's what happened in various places.
Yeah. So, no, I mean with the bathhouses. Did they keep them open?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Actually, that's not a... We could start those kinds of discussion groups all over the country now. Those would be a good thing, don't you think?
Well, it's very difficult to bring independent thought to some of these public issues that have to do with science. Our problem today is that many things seem to have a component of expertise that's beyond most of us. And so we have to have recourse to experts in order to have opinions. I mean, for a layperson to have much of an opinion on whether we ought to close the borders to people from West Africa is probably a somewhat uninformed response. You could say yes or you could say no, but I don't know whether any of us who are not doctors and who are not epidemiologists would have enough expertise to bring facts to that discussion.
Mm-hmm.
In the time of Washington and Adams and Jefferson and Madison, the science was not beyond them. They were easily able to do it. It was still possible at that time for any one person to know anything about all the science in all the world.
That's a remarkable thought right there. Our guest this hour is Tom Shachman, and Tom has written a fascinating book on gentlemen scientists and revolutionaries, the founding fathers and the age of enlightenment. He tells great stories about Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, John Adams, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Tom Paine, and many others who not only were tinkering with experiments, who were using some pretty sophisticated methods of farming, who were using scientific analogies in their writing, and had, as we have discovered this hour, political ideas that were couched in scientific terms. And so we're talking about that this hour and welcoming phone calls. Pepin, thanks so much for your interesting call. There are some lines open now if you'd like to join us. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email, talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow, during this time period, you probably heard about this walkout of hundreds of high school students in Jefferson County, Colorado. They were very concerned about the history curriculum. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow during our first hour. And then the second hour of the show, several of the members of the cast of The Color Purple, which is now at the Milwaukee Rep. Back to phone calls for Tom Shachman, and we go to Al in Madison. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Al.
The thing that I wanted to point out, I do believe that every one of the people that Shachman is talking about is also a member, and their morality is from the Freemasons.
Tom?
I'm not sure what the question is, Al.
Can you tell, were they associated with the Freemasons? What the philosophy
some
is?
Some of them were, not all. They certainly didn't get much. What they did get from Freemasonry was a pledge that anybody who was a fellow Mason would look them in the eye and treat them squarely and could be counted on to say true things. There was nothing much more to it than that in terms of you know, no cabal or anything like that having to do with the Freemasons. Freemasonry was much more of an attitude towards life and a club than it was anything else.
We go to Laura in Green Bay. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I tuned in a little late, so I probably didn't catch all this, but when you said that the Founding Fathers were not necessarily deist. Well, I always thought deists were people who found God in nature or natural law and did not necessarily adhere to an organized religion. And I thought what you said about them seems to fit that deist definition.
Well, they were deists. Some of them were admitted deists, such as Franklin, and others were I don't want to call it closet deist, but they just never used the word about themselves. I mean, Washington considered himself to be a religious man, and everything we know about him says that he was, but not in and typically go to church every Sunday type. His beliefs were personal. He also had an extremely strong belief in the right of every individual to worship in the way that that individual saw fit to do it. And I think that that certainly is what Madison stood for, and is one of his major contributions is our clause that separates the state and religion, and that gives freedom of religion, in a sense, a freedom to choose whatever religion you wanted. Adams was probably the most doctrinaire religious or old-fashioned religious of all of them, but even he defected from the Puritanism of his youth to something a little less constricting during the Revolutionary War. So I think they were all believers in God, but that certainly did not dissuade them from any of their understandings of science or their belief that science was applicable to the kinds of things that they were doing.
Was it Adams who became a Quaker, or was that somebody else?
Pardon me?
Was it Adams who became a Quaker, or was it somebody else later in life?
Adams, yes, became closer to Quakerhood, shall we say. But Quakerism then is not very far from the mainstream Protestantism of the time. It was far from Puritanism, which was extremely strict and which tried to regulate people's lives. One of the reasons for the American Revolution was to get out from under the idea that the Church of England was going to tell everybody how to behave, how to believe, and where to do so. One of the benefits of being in the colonies was being away from the central headquarters of the Church of England, so that people were able to set up their own congregations and whatever belief system they had, and to follow that.
We haven't talked about Alexander Hamilton, and this story is just so amazing. He's on this itsy-bitsy island in the Caribbean, loses his father young, and yet has this scientific mind, and eventually winds up in New York. Can you talk about him?
Well, Hamilton had what, by all accounts, was a terrifying childhood, in which his father was absent, his mother had very bad circumstances, all of his relatives except his siblings died. I'm talking about grandparents and uncles and aunts and everything. And he finally found his way to the protection of a journalist and preacher there, and who got him a job. And he did so wonderfully at the job and was so obviously a good writer that people took up a collection to send him to New York.
Wow.
To go to school. And he wasn't quite ready for the school in New York, so he was sent to a prep school in New Jersey. And he just came from there. One of the things that he did while he finally reached college was he practically took his degree in medicine. And his physician later said that he understood more about anatomy than anybody else who was not a physician. So he had a training in some of that. But Hamilton's great strength was as an economist. And as an economist, he understood implicitly the value of technology and new technology to what he saw as America's destiny, which was to become an industrial colossus. And it's in that way that he was sort of a scientist. He was not an experimenter in the way that some of the others were, and he was much more grounded in shall we say, social sciences than in the hard sciences. But he certainly had an understanding of what science was, and even a greater understanding of what technology could contribute to the country.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Laura, for your call. Susan in Duluth. Hi.
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 I was wondering if your guest, in his lengthy research, had formed any opinion about Dr. Benjamin Rush's unscientific bleeding of George Washington, which caused his death.
Well, there are parts of what you say that's correct and parts incorrect. Let me just check that for the moment. Rush was a great believer in bleeding people to get them well. He did not treat Washington. People who he had trained did treat Washington. And Washington was bled mercilessly for a throat infection that possibly could have been treated in some other way. And he assented in this. Unfortunately, they bled him, as I say, fairly mercilessly, almost a third of the blood in his body, which hastened his death at what we now would consider a relatively young age. And Dr. Rush had many, many contributions to American medicine. Among them, he's considered the father of psychiatry in the United States. And he was a premier medical educator. However, he was very badly wrong on the whole idea of bleeding people. So it's very difficult to assess his entire contribution there, but he was not directly responsible for Washington's death. And had he been apprised, he later said, of what was being done in for Washington in response to a particular condition, he said that he would have advocated something else.
Thank you, Susan. Robert in Franklin, hi.
Hi there. Kathleen, I'd like to ask our guest how he thinks, it's kind of a rhetorical question, how he thinks our founding fathers might react today if they saw so many of our political leaders denying what the science says about the world and the role of our government in that, specifically in the areas of climate change, but also since he mentioned a bit ago also Hamilton as an economist, economic science, you know. It seems to me there's often a great denial of our current political leadership of science and what then they might think about the state of our future, state of our republic. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Robert.
Now, if there ever was a loaded question, that's it, huh? So let's just take a little crack at it. First of all, one of the things that struck me about these founding fathers was that their ability to learn and to learn from changing science and changing facts. Jefferson, for example, who was obviously one of the brightest of men alive at that time, did not think that there was such a thing as extinction of species. He also thought that, along with the leading French scientist Buffon, that there had been no change since the days of the Garden of Eden, that everything was as it was. There was no evolution. But towards the end of his life, when evidence began coming in that there had been things such as extinction and that evolution was a distinct possibility, he began to change. And there's a similar thing that had happened in other fields to Washington and also to Adams, who continued to be a keen student of science when he was in Europe and trying to get his son ready for Harvard and so on. So my sense is first that the founding fathers were learners and that they were willing to learn from science as science itself developed. And I think that what we're seeing today is a willful denial of what the facts are that science is accumulating in terms of global warming and climate change due to human presence. So I'm disturbed by that aspect of it. I'm always disturbed when people disregard facts and try and substitute some other system of understanding of what's going on. So I guess that's my answer to it. One can't say, you know, yes, George Washington would have been a climate denier or he would have been in favor of understanding climate change and doing something about it. I think we can't really mix those two. But we can talk about people's ability to learn and willingness to learn from the fact. So I think that's where we can understand something from the founding fathers.
Yeah, they sure had that in full measure. It's a good thing they did. Thank you so much, Tom, for being with us.
I'm delighted to have been here. Thank you.
Thanks for writing the book. The book is Gentlemen, Scientists, and Revolution, The Founding Fathers in the Age of Enlightenment. Tom Shackman is the author. Tom is the author of Absolute Zero and the Conquest of Cold and Rumspringa, To Be or Not to Be Amish, among other books. He's written a number of documentaries for ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, BBC, and he's also written for the New York Times, Newsday, Smithsonian, Huffington Post, History News Network, and Foreign Policy. We thank him for this fascinating hour. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for helping out. Thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production, and to you for all of your interesting calls this hour. Tomorrow, the controversy over the history curriculum in Colorado, in a high school area where a lot of hundreds of students walked out of the school, and we'll be talking with three of the cast members from The Color Purple, currently at the Milwaukee Rep. So please join us. Thank you for listening.